Hello, and welcome to Wellness Wednesday with 3W. Wellness Wednesday is sponsored by 3W Medical for Women, a nonprofit medical clinic offering free of charge or low-cost reproductive health services to women in the Seattle area, regardless of income or insurance status. 3W does not profit off of the reproductive health choices women make. The information shared in this podcast is the opinion of the speaker or speakers. Medical information is not intended as individual medical consultation, but for general education only. Always consult your own health professional for personalized advice regarding medical decisions. And if you're in the Seattle area, consider making an appointment to consult with us. I'm Helen Nguyen, CEO and co-founder of 3W Medical for Women and the host of today's podcast. Hi there, Wellness Wednesday listeners. This is yours truly, Helen, back in the studio. Feels like it's been a while, but we've been going through so much stuff, so much growth and so much expansion and setbacks, and it just seems like a never-ending cycle, but I'm always so grateful to be back in the studio. Today, we have a pretty special guest with us. Her name is Becca. She's actually related to one of our staff here at 3W. And Becca comes with a plethora of knowledge as a licensed mental health counselor. So welcome, Becca.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Thank you. So she was just telling me that usually Mondays are her chill days and she gets to roll out of bed in pajamas. And today she's sitting in front of me and she just looks wonderful.
Oh my goodness.
And I am so honored to have her in our studio and just talking about this really heavy topic. And Becca, do you want to introduce the topic?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was really honored when you guys asked me to come speak and there was so many things when talking to Teresa about what the topic might be that we ended up deciding maybe it's best not to try to hit everything all at once that is on my heart or that's part of my story. Mm-hmm. So truly today, I think part of my heart is to share my experience with mental health. I am a counselor, and part of what got me to where I am today is my own journey through mental health struggles, through relationships with counselors, people who supported me through my mental health journey. Mm-hmm. And for those who are listening, like, my heart would be to really identify with them, to help them see that they're not alone in their struggles and that there is hope, and maybe just to bring a little bit of that comfort and maybe even a little bit of, like, resource, like, hey, here's some directions that we can go if this is a place that you find yourself in dealing with mental health struggles.
Yeah. And it's such a huge topic to take on. And so I'm so glad that you and Teresa have kind of honed in on what we're going to kind of just be at the tip of the spear today. And I'm sure, you know, we would love to have you back for so many other topics that you're an expert on or just have lived through it yourself, because those stories are very powerful. Those experiences are very powerful. And those experiences, though, as powerful as they are, very much seem very isolating, right, from other people. And so having you be today, I know the conversation is going to be wonderful because you seem, from this little interaction that I've had with you, like, such an authentic and genuine person. And I think that's going to come off and just resonate with a lot of people. Right. So I just love, let's dive in to just get to know you. You know, who are you? You know, why did you get into this field? Why do you like it?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I do like it. I love what I do. Yeah, so I'm Becca, and I'm 29 years old, just turned 29 last month. I went to school, undergrad for psychology, and then my master's in clinical mental health counseling. Mm-hmm. So that was, I think, 3 years ago now. I graduated from that grad program, immediately started a private practice. And so I am currently a counselor in private practice, working mostly telehealth with clients all across Washington State.
Okay, wonderful. And how do people get a hold of you, or do you have a website?
Yes, I do. So my practice is called Every Breath Counseling. Oh. And so my website is www.everybreathcounseling.com.
Okay.
Email Becca@everybreathcounseling.com.
Okay. Wonderful. Teresa will have that link on our description in this podcast. And
what drew you to mental health?
Yeah.
You touched a little bit on it about how you needed it yourself at some point, I'm
sure.
Yes. And what did that look like?
Yeah. Oh, I wish I could say it was just a moment. It'd be easier to talk about if it was just a moment. But I guess similar to most people who find themselves in a profession, a helping profession, but specifically mental health counseling, it usually comes out of a place of our own hurts, our own struggles, and then the help that we've received. So I would say from probably middle school was dealing with depressive and anxious tendencies, symptoms. Okay. Didn't have a formal diagnosis at the time, but as many people might identify, just lived in my head a lot. So, and I think for kids, for young girls especially, it's pretty common.
Yes.
It's not like necessarily a disordered trait to live in our heads or to overthink or to feel big emotions at that age. But where I think it became maladaptive or unhelpful for me was the lack of emotional awareness or knowing, you know, really having skills. How do I understand and communicate, express, move through these big emotions and these kind of what felt like really crazy thoughts at the time? About myself, about others, about the world. And I think growing up in the home that I did, we didn't have a whole lot of conversation around emotions and not much expression around emotions other than maybe, you know, happy, sad, mad, which maybe most people are, that's kind of what they experience growing up.
Sure.
And so a lot of just lack of awareness, lack of conversation around it. And because of that, a lot of shame, right? So, oh my gosh, I have these big emotions. I have these thoughts. And then there's all these things going on in our teen years that trigger these emotions and thoughts pretty consistently. And then not being able to know what to do with it. There's this sense of like, there's something wrong with me. Why am I feeling so intensely? Why am I thinking these things about myself and about others? It started in about probably high school for me. I was starting to have thoughts of suicide or thoughts of, you know, why am I here? And am I a good person? Am I, you know, worthy of being in relationships with people who are, who I see as good, right? So my parents, my friends, my teachers, my coaches. So just these narratives that went so deep at that time in my life. And probably the cherry on top was it, I was isolated. I didn't know that I could talk to anybody about it. And so it was just me and my thoughts and my feelings. And I think that's when at that point in high school, later in high school is when I got diagnosed with clinical depression.
Okay. I have a couple of questions as you're talking through that. So you said these types of thoughts and behaviors kind of started very early in middle school. Can you give me an example of what that looked like?
I would say some of the earliest kind of core memories around these, the bigger thoughts and emotions, or what we would call core beliefs or these core narratives that we internalize as kids, were usually around, for me, performance, accomplishment, attaining a sense of perfection.
Okay.
So the culture I grew up in, Asian American culture, I think a lot of people who listen to this who identify as Asian American and maybe grew up in an Asian American home, there's often what we see as a high expectation to perform, to achieve, to present yourself a certain way. And I definitely fell into those beliefs that, you know, my goodness or my morality or my worth was found in what I did.
What you achieved.
Yeah, what I achieved, how I performed, how others saw me. And so, and there wasn't a whole lot of conversation around like, well, what if you're not, what if you make a mistake? We just didn't talk about mistakes, right? Mistakes and failures. We didn't show them. It was just only showed the best parts of you and the pretty polished parts.
Yeah.
So at a very young age, I think I bought into that narrative, and the thoughts that I would have as a result of that were a lot of shameful thoughts about myself. So a lot of I statements, things like I am bad, right? So like I am at my core, there's something fundamentally wrong with me. I'm broken. I'm unlovable unless I'm able to offer or meet a need for somebody else, right? That love is for some reason conditional or
transactional.
And in that place, I think I realized when I was in middle school and high school, well, I can't be perfect. I can't meet all the expectations I think I'm supposed to meet. And therefore, why even try? And that I think led to a lot of the helplessness, hopelessness, despair, which are symptoms of depression. Mm. And then when that starts to build, that's when we start to see that clinical long-term mm-hmm. diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. How early on were your suicidal thoughts, would you say?
I think I started considering just more passive suicide. So there's that difference between passive and active suicidal ideation. Passive, yeah. more like, I wouldn't mind if I died.
Yeah.
Wouldn't mind if that car hit me mm-hmm. or like, you mm-hmm. know, I wouldn't be sad mm-hmm. if, you know, I lost my life. Mm-hmm. I remember those as early as middle school. I have mm-hmm. journals still where I kind of look back and I'm like, wow, like I was writing about imagining different ways that I
not could. Existing.
Yeah. And almost thinking like, wow, that would be kind of nice. Mm-hmm. Right. To not have to be stuck in these thoughts mm-hmm. all the time, to not have to feel like I'm never enough or that I'll never get to where I think I'm supposed to get. Mm-hmm. It might be just easier to not exist. Mm-hmm. So those passive thoughts started as early as maybe sixth, seventh grade, and then more active thoughts end of high school, early college. So mm-hmm. I think a little bit of these triggering events that kind of led to more of those active thoughts mm-hmm. and just reaching a place in my college years where I felt like I had tried all these different things and nothing really worked. Mm-hmm. And that overall hopelessness and helplessness led mm-hmm. to an actual suicide attempt when I was a junior in college.
What events led up yeah. to that moment?
Oh, there's just so much compounding from, I would say, early childhood, probably memories I don't even remember.
Yeah.
All the way up through that point in time. But I guess more distinct kind of milestones that I think led to my suicide attempt. One was a deep sense of, I don't know. Nobody in this world knows the real me. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I kind of wrestled with all through middle school and high school, was this like, I can't show, you know, my true self because mm-hmm. it wouldn't be acceptable or people wouldn't love me if they really knew what I was thinking and feeling or mm-hmm. these kind of like yucky, ugly parts of me that only I let myself see. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't experience love and acceptance. So that just really getting really good at being two-faced, really good at putting on that pretty smile and that mask that said I have it all together and mm-hmm. I'm friendly and I'm warm and, you know, just giving people what they need or what mm-hmm. I thought they needed. Mm-hmm. And where that led me was this sense of, well, there are zero people on this earth who mm-hmm. actually know me. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. if no one loves me, then I can't be, or if no one knows me, then I can't be loved. Mm-hmm. If no one really truly knows the real Becca, then nobody really truly loves the real Becca. Mm-hmm. And that for me was like, what's the point of being on this earth if I don't get to be loved, mm-hmm. right? Or if I don't experience genuine love. Mm-hmm. I would say that's a big, deep narrative that motivated me to try to take my own life. Mm-hmm. And then I think more like just environmental circumstantial events at the time. I was in an emotionally abusive relationship, mm. felt very trapped in that, had kind of walked away from my faith, which had been very grounding for me mm. for most of my childhood. Mm. And then at that point, feeling very lost in terms of what's my purpose in life. Do I have value, you know, outside of myself? Yeah, a lot of social separation. So, you know, losing friends, relationships in my life. And so just all these things compounding to, yeah, like what's the point? Mm-hmm.
Well, I just want to pause and just say thank you for being so vulnerable right now for yeah. about that moment. That's not a fun thing to think about, I'm sure.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it makes me emotional because I think about people in my life mm-hmm. that have been in that moment. Yeah. And to just think about you not being here mm-hmm. is really tough for me. Yeah. yeah. So I'm sorry.
No.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I think that I, in an interesting way, have learned how to feel that level of compassion for myself, which at yeah. first many people I think who deal with suicidal thoughts, suicide attempts, when they think back on that time or even if they're dealing with it in the moment, there isn't compassion for self. There's actually shame.
Yeah.
So more shame. Shame that yeah. I feel shame, right?
Yeah.
Shame that I even have these thoughts. Shame that right. I am not more grateful to be alive. And
right.
And if anything, that only exacerbates that symptom or that desire.
Yeah.
But through, you know, my own experience in counseling and the support and love from others and compassion from people, I mean, even just like you sitting here, it's a reminder to me of like when I think back at my high school and college self, like,
yeah,
I see her through a lens of compassion now. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, like what happened in my life leading up to that was not my fault.
Yeah.
I didn't choose a lot of those things, even the things that maybe I did, the choices that I made that weren't beneficial.
Yeah.
Was doing the best with what I knew. And
yeah,
there, I don't think there's any person who's born into this world wanting to die.
I don't think so either. Yeah. And that's such a great point for people who are feeling alone and for people who are feeling like, oh, if I wasn't here tomorrow, mm-hmm. who would that really impact? And unfortunately, I've had to say that to people in my life before. It's like, gosh, do you not know life would be so different?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you weren't here, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's really hard to just imagine young you having to have to deal with such these massive thoughts mm-hmm. of and mm-hmm. that how that is so overwhelming.
Yeah.
So eventually, who did you talk to and what mm-hmm. did that, you know, talking about your suicide, what did that moment look like?
Yeah, I guess with just kind of wisdom around not wanting to be too graphic. In my personal experience with the suicide attempt, it was attempting to overdose. And I can't say that there was any person or even myself that stopped it. I say it was God protecting my life.
Yeah.
That's what I fully believe. But coming off of that attempt, there was something in me. And again, maybe this is God's grace, but that felt like I needed to share. I needed to tell somebody. I couldn't keep it to myself. At the time, I guess I'll rewind just a little bit, but that night after my attempt, it was my boyfriend at the time who mm-hmm. found me. Mm-hmm. And his reaction was not compassionate. It was actually anger. Mm. And so this was at a time in my life where, yeah, this relationship I was in was very unhealthy. And the amount of fear that I experienced in that moment and shame over what I had tried to do felt overwhelming to the point where I was in a weird way. I guess I could have gone either way where it would have maybe led me back into another suicide attempt. But I almost felt like, wow, I'm desperate and this is not okay. Like something, I guess, woke up in me.
Yeah.
So it was after that where I was, I'm not going to go to this person for safety or for comfort after this. This isn't safe. And I actually went to my family, who at the time I wasn't actually in relationship with. I had emotionally disconnected from them because of shame.
Yeah.
But my mom was the first person that I told that day after it happened. And it wasn't like in that moment I was ready for healing or, you know, I didn't want to go to counseling. I was still pretty hopeless, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But it was just that sense of I'm not alone in it anymore. Like someone is with me mm-hmm. and she's not trying to fix it. I mean, she was heartbroken, but she accepted me in that. She wasn't angry. And so I think even in just that, I was able to experience maybe for the first time in a long time, unconditional love and acceptance. Mm-hmm. Which I believe was healing, even though I didn't really realize it at the time. But yeah, it wasn't for another, maybe over a year, that I actually pursued professional support.
So, you know, you mentioned yourself as like someone who put on a show a lot of your life to be like, you know, the straight A student, probably this like perfect daughter. And I think, you know, identifying with you in a lot of sense of like just the pressure of being Asian in school and being that model daughter, right? Mm-hmm. Did you ever at some point try to tell your parents that you're just like, look, I'm just – I just remember for myself, I remember bringing home an A on a test one time and my mom goes – where's the plus next to it? You know, my mom's a straight up tiger mom. So I get, you know, I in some ways I was very used to that type of response. Mm-hmm. Maybe I programmed myself to be just used to it and it didn't impact me as much. But I can't imagine saying that to my son now.
Right.
You know, what was the response that you would have liked from your parents?
That emotional vulnerability is for parents to be able to come to their kids and say, mommy, daddy's not perfect. In fact, we are kind of, we're learning as we go too. And here's the mistakes that we've made, but here's how we've grown from them. And that's the mistake you made. And that's not helpful, but here's how we grow from it. Here's how we learn. there's this sense of humanization of, mm-hmm. of the parent versus this idolization. Mm-hmm. And I dealt a lot with this idolization that, I mean, led to that perfectionist part. Mm-hmm. And perfectionism is always going to lead to the same place of, you know, paralysis. Like we just can't, we can never attain it. And therefore, eventually we just give up.
I think most of our listeners know I'm Catholic and I practice my faith, my Christian faith. I think God has a fantastic sense of humor in my life in the sense of, you know, I get to be the CEO of this amazing organization and I get to be in this leadership role and I get invited, Becca, I get invited to, you know, important dinners and mm-hmm. stuff where mm-hmm. I have to dress up, which I dread at this point. There is nothing like going to an important dinner, being the speaker potentially, you know, mm-hmm. looking really good that day, you right. know, and then coming home. And my three-year-old we just went through potty training, I guess, uh-huh. right? Nothing like coming home and he going like, Mom, I gotta poop. Or when he was going through his whole like holding his poop phase, which mm-hmm. is a thing that boys mm-hmm. do, by the way. Mm-hmm. And having to stick an enema up his butt, oh, you know, gosh. In a full-blown makeup yep. dress. Yep. Kind of stuff. There's nothing like that.
Oh my
you
gosh.
Just got to stick something up a toddler's butt yep. and wait for him to poop and cheer for him while he poops, right. you know. Aww. He is just so proud of himself mm-hmm. for pooping in the toilet. And mm-hmm. I feel like that is like quintessential parenting. Mm. That's what being a parent is about. Yeah. That's what being a mom is about. This mantle of being this leader of this organization, yeah. which I guarantee you takes obviously a crap ton of people mm-hmm. to allow me to sit here in this space and mm-hmm. allow me to have this conversation. It takes a village of people.
Yeah.
And the village of people also remind me that my son makes up that village mm-hmm. of people. And he goes, I don't care what you look like right now. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you look good right now. Mm-hmm. Your eyelashes look great. Mm-hmm. I need you to clean up my butt.
Yep.
And I want so badly as he gets older to be like, yeah, your mom gets to play boss, but she's your mom. Like, yeah. That's my goal yeah. is to tell him that, like, I'll clean up after you
yeah.
any moment of my life. Mm. And what a wonderful opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. That's beautiful.
But I think for my own parents, my own personal parents, they did all of that. They just didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
They just,
oh my gosh, yeah.
They just didn't have mm-hmm. the ability to like conceptualize it, internalize it, and verbalize it.
Mm-hmm.
It was mm-hmm. just for survival. Yeah. It's like
absolutely.
You're fed, you're healthy, you have food on the table, you yeah. have clothes on your backs. Like, why do we have to talk about this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why do you have to talk about that? And I'm not saying that was like wrong. I'm just saying that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. That's and I think that's what they at the time were taught was that that's the best way to love your kid.
Right. Yeah.
And that generation, I mean, yeah. that they did so much. They worked so hard.
Oh, yeah.
To provide and mm-hmm. protect and meet all of those needs.
Yeah.
And I do think that it benefited, you mm-hmm. know, me in so many ways. And mm-hmm. I think similar to your story. Yeah, yeah. My parents did so much. I knew my parents loved me. Yeah. I absolutely knew that. Yeah. I just didn't know that they were also going through their own stuff and that they were imperfect yes. and that it was okay to be yeah. messy, you yes. know, with them.
Yeah.
But again, it wasn't for a lack of like their care. It was mm-hmm. they did not know.
Right. Their toolbox mm-hmm. was in some ways didn't have that tool.
Yeah.
They exactly. were missing that tool. And it's not their fault and it's not anyone to blame. It's just that mm-hmm. tool was just missing.
Yeah.
And I think we get to sit now in a space and as you know, walk through your own journey of being married and, you know, having kids and all that stuff, that's mm-hmm. it's gonna come up where you're oh my gosh, now I know why my mom did what she did or why uh-huh. she got so angry, you know, mm-hmm. because they haven't been taught to be like, look, I had a hard day, yeah. you need to give me 5 minutes, right? Or whatever. It's just like, what do you want? I need you to stop.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
mm-hmm. and that meant like having to internalize that yeah. in a lot of ways and not being able to communicate that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And giving grace to them at this point in my life is like, yeah, thank you for doing what you
yes.
do. You
yes.
know? That's what you had to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I mean, all that to say, like, when was that moment for you mm. when you realized that? You know, you said it took a year for yeah. you to finally get professional help. And yeah. what did that look like? Did people say, Becca, you need to go see someone, you need to go talk to someone?
Yeah, such a good question. So my suicide attempt was actually the night before my 21st birthday. So it wasn't until a little bit after I turned 22 when that relationship that I was in, mm-hmm. that was emotionally abusive, that ended. Mm-hmm. We had been in and out of breakups and getting back together for so long that I mm-hmm. had no idea if this was going to last, but this one did, miraculously. I'm so grateful. And I think that was really the catalyst for me mm-hmm. to actually start like connecting with others, because mm-hmm. in that relationship, I was so isolated.
Isolated.
It was just me and him, and I had mm-hmm. no perspective. I mm-hmm. had no truth being spoken into me. I was just so caught up in distortion and mm-hmm. confusion and mm-hmm. and hopelessness and loneliness. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a big shift for me, was all of a sudden I was connecting with friends. I actually moved back home to live with my family, even mm-hmm. though our relationships were not strong, and I was still very much holding them at arm's length. At least I was in a safe home.
I went back to your base.
Exactly.
In a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was an adult at this time too, so that was completely different, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to rebuild relationships with them in a new way. But it was through that, just that open door of reconnecting with family, I actually started going to the church that my parents were attending mm-hmm. kind of off and on. And at the time, like I mentioned, you know, my faith was so unstable, and mm. it was just wavering, and I just really didn't think that God would accept me after everything that I had been going through and the stuff that I had done. But, you know, I think, again, by his grace, it was a women's retreat that I attended with my mom when I was 23 years old. It was just there where, for the first time, I encountered what real grace was, mm. and kind of like I was sharing with grace mm-hmm. and truth, right? Like I had lived all of my life really understanding truth and really understanding expectation and this action part, like performance and accomplishment. But I just didn't understand that I was loved how I was mm-hmm. for who I was. Mm-hmm. And it was at that retreat where I had a revelation mm-hmm. and God really spoke to me about how acceptable mm-hmm. I was, even mm-hmm. in my mess, mm-hmm. even in my brokenness, mm-hmm. even in my shame. And it was at that retreat, too, that I was able to reconnect with my mom. And there was probably some of the most vivid core memories for me were at that retreat, just sitting with her and for the first time letting her see me, right, and mm-hmm. and confessing just a lot of the things that I thought were too shameful to share. Mm-hmm. And then her as well, just connecting with me and sharing with me her heart and her story and mm-hmm. It's an experience I cherish to this day, and I pray that, you know, every person, every child, adult child can have with their parents at some point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say that was probably the catalyst for me in terms of, okay, I have hope for myself again. Mm. I feel unconditionally loved and accepted, even though I'm fully known, right? I'm fully known, and yet I'm still fully loved. And then from there, it was like, okay, I want to heal. Right. Mm-hmm. I do feel like even if I didn't heal, I would still be loved. Mm-hmm. And so from that place where it's not like I have to figure this all out, it was like I get to go, and I get to see, you know, what got me to this point, understand why I am this way, why my thoughts went that direction, why my behaviors were the way they were. And then I get to make some decisions on mm-hmm. if I want to stay in that or if there are other options for me. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started seeing a counselor. At the time, I was battling an eating disorder, so I also saw nutritionists. I was meeting with pastors and mm-hmm. mentors and my mm-hmm. my parents, and just, I mean, it took a village, I'll mm-hmm. say. It wasn't just counseling, but it was really this whole community of people who loved me, who mm-hmm. came around me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for, you know, giving us a glimpse into kind of the beginning mm-hmm. in a lot of ways of this journey of recovery from that. So when you realized that things weren't hopeless and that things can turn around, in your opinion and in your professional opinion, what comes first? Is it a feeling mm. that you have to experience for that to click? Or is it usually a decision?
Right.
Because sometimes I think in our youth, in mm-hmm. our generations, it's so much about if it feels good, do it. If it doesn't feel good, I guess you're not supposed to do it.
Yeah.
Right. But what came first for you? Was it the feeling or the head, you know, or the brain, you know?
Right. I think that it's tricky because in a lot of ways, I would say it wasn't one after the other. I think for me, a lot of it was an experience. There was something that I was freed from when I realized that I was unconditionally loved and accepted. So that was almost like, for me, there was that barrier of like shame, hopelessness that I couldn't get through. And when I realized like, wow, I'm actually accepted as I am right now, being fully known and fully loved, that wall came down. And then there was this opportunity for me to make a choice. And so I wouldn't say there was necessarily this like, I feel like I really want to go to counseling and I feel like I really want to dig up all of these, you know, wounds, dig into them. And essentially it's like surgery, right? Like I don't want to go and have to confront this. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that it wasn't necessarily a feeling of motivation so much so as a like, wow, I recognize that I need this and I recognize that people believe in me. Like I can do this and there are resources available to me and I want to be better. I want to be more whole. I want to be healthier for myself, for those that I love, for God. And so I would say, yeah, kind of to your point, it was more of a decision and it was with the motivation of like there is hope and there is something good and it's going to be worth it even though it is uncomfortable. I mean, open heart surgery, right? It is essentially what we're doing, emotional surgery, mental surgery. It's so uncomfortable. And yet, you know, my clients come to me every day and I'm so proud of them because it's exhausting. And yet they show up for themselves and for those around them. So yeah, I agree. I don't think that if I had waited for a moment where it just felt easy to go and do this work to receive healing and to take action and rewrite the narratives that I had written for so long, I mean, I would say probably still would be stuck in it, right?
Thank you for your expert opinion about that. I guess I had to take a step back and go like, well, it's going to be probably different for every person and where they're at. So if you were a young woman, 16, 17, that's going through what you're going through back then. And you listened to this podcast. Would you have listened to the expert on the podcast?
Oh, you know, it would have been nice at 16 or 17 to know that I wasn't alone. I think that if I had first heard the message, this is normal, or you're not broken, or you're not bad for going through this, I might listen after that. But if I simply heard the, you need to go do the hard thing and get help and you need to go be uncomfortable and go suffer a little bit in order to heal. No, probably not.
Yeah. I reflected on that a little bit of, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts because I'm interested in all of this stuff, but I always try to put myself in the shoes of myself when I was a teenager and I go, would I have listened to this?
Right.
Or did I have to go through what I had to go through to go, oh, crap, I should have listened to this, right? There's so many times that I'm like, dang, missed that boat, you know, missed that train. Why do I have to go? Why do I have to approach this the tough way?
Yeah.
And in so many ways, I had to like reflect on that and be okay with the answer of you got to learn it the hard way sometimes.
Yeah.
There is not. There isn't. Maybe that was because it had to happen that way for me to come out at the other end and go, when my mom said the stove is on and it's hot, shouldn't have touched it probably, you know. But there's that beauty of like life is just messy, right? Life is messy.
And I think to your point, we learn the greatest lessons through experience. We can be told over and over again what is true, and yet we don't really believe it in our hearts until we experience it as truth. Like we then have evidence, right? To support that truth.
Right.
Versus, you know, our parents can tell us over and over again something that is obviously true, and we probably won't actually digest that until we experience it. I love that, though, because I do think as somebody who gets a front row seat at, you know, the unfortunately the suffering that people go through, that probably one of the hardest parts is not wanting to jump in and fix it and solve it and just get them to believe the truth that I know is true because I've experienced it.
Right.
You know, just like shake them and because I love them.
Yes.
You know, why don't you see that this is? And then, yeah, it's like, oh, my gosh, I have to check myself probably every session. It's like, OK, like this is exactly what they need to get to the point where they're going to believe this.
Yeah.
But in order to get there, they have to go through exactly what it is that they're going through. So patience, right?
Yes.
Just consistency, reliability, being somebody who is safe for them to not be alone as they journey through whatever suffering or whatever mistakes or hiccups they need to go through to get to where they do really believe what is true.
Yeah. If you had the opportunity to speak into a parent's life that has a teenager that's going through this right now, what would you say?
When I speak to the parents of teens that I work with, I often just start with, you're not alone. For parents who care, right? So parents who are genuinely like, I want the best for my teen.
Right.
They can often deal with a lot of shame. So just normalizing, you're not alone. You're the way that your teen is acting, as hard as it is for you to be on the receiving end of your teen right now, your teen is normal. The outbursts they're having, or the emotional, you know, dysregulation they're having, or the thoughts they're having, or the words that, you know, they're saying to you that are that hurt your feelings, it's painful, but it's normal. And so it's not a flaw or a mistake or a lack of parenting, but it reflects normalcy. And so to give them more so that first validation, normalization, grace for yourself. And then from that place, it's, you know, some tools, right? It's like, hey, how do we build connection? How do we build trust? How do we become emotionally vulnerable with our kids? How do you let them see you and and maybe these parts of you that you don't feel maybe comfortable to share in order for them to then feel comfortable to share these parts of who they are with you? And then, yeah, again, just that spectrum of grace and truth. I always talk about that. Like, how do we cultivate safety, compassion, and grace while also you are the parent and you do need to set boundaries for them.
Yeah.
You do need to give them, you know, some structure and some direction and some consequence, right? Discipline is important. And that doesn't make you a bad parent either if your kid doesn't like you because you gave them a consequence. It is loving. And so even just reaffirming in them, like, that's love. Both grace and truth are love, even if your teen doesn't receive it.
And what would you say to a 17-year-old that's sitting in your office going, what's the point of this life? Yeah. It sucks. And the pressure is just too much.
Right.
You know, this is a cool conversation, but when I leave here, all of it comes rushing back. What's the point?
To be honest, I think it would really depend on who I'm talking to and, you know, what their story is and what our relationship is. But the goal in that moment for me is just connection, genuine connection. So rather than, oh, I need to get you out of the place that you're in, I need to, like, get you to love your life or get you to discover your meaning all in this one moment, it's how do I meet you where you're at? And sometimes that looks like just curiosity. Yeah, tell me more about your thoughts and why you think that or why you feel that way. Maybe tell me how you feel about telling that to me. Like, what is it like for you to share that with me? That's pretty, you know, that's a heavy thing you just shared. And just getting curious, showing interest, like, wow, I want to understand and I want to be with you in this, even though you might feel shame about it, even though it's uncomfortable to talk about, even though I would really, really love for you not to be in that place. So yeah, I would say meeting them where they're at. And then as there is that level of trust built, then maybe there is room for exploration and curiosity around what does bring joy and meaning into life and being able to gain perspective and see past the moment and, you know, all the skill building around cognitive resilience and emotion regulation. But I think in those moments, I would probably just lean into connection.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being you and sharing your story. And there's so much to talk about. There's so many little paths that we can go down, which we have already kind of done so at this point. But I'm grateful for your insight and grateful for this wave of life that you've gone through, because now you're at the other end of it, being able to assist others that are going through that. Your story is unique to yourself, but I'm sure it resonates with a lot of people out there right now. So thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing your story, your heart.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for giving me the space to do that.
Yeah. It's been really cool. So I'm sure our listeners really appreciate Becca's story and Becca, you're open to people reaching out, right? After Absolutely. They listen to this and Absolutely. Just shoot you a quick email if they have anything that they need to say mm-hmm. or would like to come see you potentially, yeah. you know, I'm sure you're open to that. But I think what I'm walking away listening and just hearing from you is just like, we are made to be in community. Mm. And whenever you feel like you're not, reach out. Like, I know that's really hard,
yeah.
but we're here, even though, you know, sometimes it's weird to reach out to a medical clinic that you went through for a pap smear or something. It's not weird to us. Like, it's yeah. really normal for us to have people reach back out. Mm-hmm. And it's with great honor that we take those opportunities and yeah. to connect with professionals like you that we can be like, hey, you need to go talk to Becca because she can really resonate. So if you're feeling alone out there, if you're feeling like no one understands you, how do I even start a conversation like this? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's simply a quick text or an email or just picking up the phone, and we'd be happy to be that person at the end of the other end of the receiving part of it. So thank you for tuning in and listening to us today. And thank you, Becca. Yeah, again,
absolutely,
for your story and your expertise. And I'm sure we'll have Becca back many, many times to talk about other things. For more information about 3W, please visit our website at 3wmedical.org. That's the number 3, the letter W, medical.org. From there, you can learn more information about the services we provide, book an appointment, or make a donation if you'd like to support our mission. You can also call our office at 206-588-0311. That's 206-588-0311. If you like this episode, please share it with others and consider subscribing on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay healthy and be well.